Vampire, der Podcast über Frauen, die schreiben.
Herzlich willkommen zu einer neuen Ausgabe von Vampire, dem Podcast über Frauen, die schreiben. Mein Name ist Lasha Chayat, ich bin Schriftstellerin, Übersetzerin, Literaturaktivistin und nun auch noch Podcast-Host. Heute freue ich mich ganz besonders, die Autorin eines meiner absoluten Lieblingsbücher des letzten Jahres begrüßen zu dürfen, und zwar die bosnische Schriftstellerin Lana Bastasic. Mit ihrem Roman Fangenden Hasen hat sie es innerhalb von kürzester Zeit zu internationalem Fame und Starstatus gebracht und überall in Europa Preise abgeräumt. Das Buch erzählt von einem Roadtrip zweier Kinderfreundinnen, aber auch von einer Reise in die Vergangenheit des früheren Jugoslawiens. Und wer das Buch bisher noch nicht kennt, der sollte es sich ganz unbedingt besorgen, ihr werdet es nicht bereuen. Gemeinsam sprechen wir über Werk und Wirken der großen jugoslawischen Autorin Dubravka Ugrešić, die Lana so sehr verehrt, dass sie sich sogar zwei Tattoos hat stechen lassen, die inspiriert sind von Dubravkas Büchern. Dubravka Ugrešić lebt seit 1993 im Exil in Amsterdam, nachdem sie für ihre kritischen Texte in ihrer Heimat als Hexe verschrien und ihre Bücher öffentlich verbrannt wurden. Sie schreibt Essays, Romane, ist Professorin und eine Feministin der ersten Stunde, und Lana verehrt sie wirklich ganz unglaublich. Ihre Begeisterung und ihr Enthusiasmus für Dubravkas Arbeit sind so ansteckend, dass ich seither immer weiter gelesen und mich nur noch mehr vertieft habe in das Werk von dieser Autorin, die ich vorher nicht kannte. Ich hoffe, es geht euch auch so und ihr genießt das Gespräch mindestens genauso sehr wie Lana und ich. Wie immer findet ihr sämtliche Infos und Links zu unserem Gespräch in der Beschreibung des Podcasts verlinkt. Klickt auch gern auf Abonnieren bei der Podcast-Plattform eurer Wahl und folgt uns bei Instagram unter vampire-podcast. Und nun ganz viel Freude mit Lana Bastasic und ihrer Heldin Dubravka Ugrešić. Lana, welcome to Vampire. I'm so happy you were able to join us today.
I'm so happy to be here. I love your podcast, at least the ones that I could listen to because they were in English. And we've been planning to do this for a while. So really, really happy to talk to you.
Me too. Yes, we have been planning this for a while, which gives me the opportunity to already say, the minute I asked you if you wanted to be part of Vampire and you graciously agreed to honor us today, your first idea already was to talk about Dubravka Ugrešić. I hope I'm pronouncing this correctly.
Yeah, Dubravka Ugrešić.
Thank you. This is the writer you brought with you today to talk about. And I have to say, the prep and the recording today filled me equally with excitement and daunt at the same time, because I haven't heard of Dubravka before you mentioned her. I now feel it's like a shame, because as I was diving into it, I just discovered an incredibly interesting, incredibly complex and challenging writer. Whose work sort of showed me again my absolute hopeless inadequacy when it comes to especially Yugoslav and post-Yugoslav history. I was born in 1978, so the memory of the war in Yugoslavia is prevalent in my mind as a child, you know, especially with we had refugee children from Yugoslavia come into our schools and such, but like I wasn't a grown-up, so I didn't even realize. So reading Dubravka's work made me dive into it even more. And then, you know, it was like a rabbit hole as such. You know, I know you don't like to talk about rabbits anymore, but then I was trying to sort of come up with, let's say, finding connecting dots or threads between you and your work and Dubravka's work. And I think I found a few. Let's see if I was on a path that will lead us somewhere. So I'm hoping that I'm not making a complete idiot of myself. But let's start with like the most obvious question, which I hope is not super annoying, because it's like, obviously, you were born in 1986, I think.
Yes.
So both you and Dubravka were born in a place that is now Croatia. Mm-hmm. But back then, even when you were born, was still Yugoslavia. And I feel like one of the most obvious connecting threads between you and her, or your work and her work, is what I would maybe call post-nationalist or post-nationalism thing, because already when I was trying to come up with the bio, as I was promoting the podcast, there was this, let's say, question marks. Like, okay, Lana Bastasic is born in Croatia, which is now Croatia. She's promoted by her publisher as Bosnian writer. In the German translation of your book, Catch the Rabbit, in German it's called Fang den Hasen. The translation is made by Rebecca Zeinzinger. It says from Bosnian, translated from Bosnian, but you live in Belgrade, which is Serbia. And Dubrovka herself, she lives in Amsterdam, so she's exiled. She's left ex-Yugoslavia, shall we say, in the early 90s. Can you talk a little bit about this issue that I feel is some like a connecting part between you and her?
Well, yeah, definitely. I mean, I'm always happy to find any kind of connection between my favorite living Yugoslav writer and myself. I have to say, you shouldn't feel bad about, you know, not knowing about her, because I think this is our post-Yugoslav collective shame, that there's a lot of literary tradition that just didn't fit in with the politics, nationalist politics, cultural politics of the 90s. So a lot of great writers, including Dubravka, were kind of pushed aside and forgotten. This is something, these are the names that we are now rediscovering and digging up and kind of trying to piece together a very rich tradition. And to understand, okay, our voices, you know, where do they come from? What was there before? So, you know, given that she has lived abroad for many years, and that, of course, her personal, you know, the way she deals with those years and her politics are not in line with the official one, she has been ignored for a very long time. And as it always happens now, she's, you know, built a name for herself with she won many important awards, essay awards. She was finalist for Man International Man Booker Prize. And now they're kind of rehabilitating her, which I'm not sure she's very comfortable with.
Interesting, though.
Yeah. And given, you know, everything that she's been through, and we're going to talk about that in a while. But I have to say, if there is a connection, and it's hard to see a connection in the style itself, in the you know, literary procedure or a gesture itself, which, I mean, it wouldn't make sense. But the way we deal with nationalism as a political choice, and also text as establishing a dialogue between a certain space that has been destroyed by these nationalist myths, and kind of trying to write above and around these myths. I would say I'm happy to be part of that tradition, definitely.
Yeah. I think also the reason why maybe I haven't been able to discover her yet, which I should have maybe even said earlier, is the fact that I really had a lot of difficulty even obtaining some of her work in German, especially. Like, I managed to get 3 essay collections, which is The Culture of Lies, which you recommended. In German, it's called Die Kultur der Lüge. And then there are 2 other essay collections, which is Karaoke Culture. And then let me see, the other one is called Keiner zu Hause, Nobody's Home, I guess. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure what the original title is. And she's written so much more. And she's also written fiction, which I now know because I read and listened to podcasts and watched her on YouTube. Because the more I heard her talk and the more I saw her, the more interesting she got to me. Because apparently her fiction, I think, maybe you can talk about that later also a little bit, her fiction seems to be incredibly interesting. And I feel it's a shame that we don't have it in Germany. So if anyone's listening now who is able to translate this, maybe you can. And also the last thing that has been translated by her, like of her work into German, is from 2012. So that's 10 years ago. So she seems to be
Which is why I think it's interesting that you say you even yourself in your own languages, you're rediscovering her now, that we haven't even given her a place in German translation as such, you know? So,
That's when you realize how, you know, domestic cultural politics actually influence all of these things, because there are people, you know, writers from her generation who, you know, live in Croatia or in Bosnia or in Serbia, who have written a lot and who have won or have been given national prizes, etc. So they're the ones that are going to be sent off to festivals. They're the ones that are going to be promoted by agents, local agents and publishers. So it's very, very hard, especially for women, I mean, but then also for somebody who is politically not in line with these people, to be promoted. But I don't think she's even that interested in in being promoted by, you know, the same, maybe not the same people, but people, you know, belonging to the same kind of line of thinking.
Yeah, that, of course.
That led to her own exile. So she's doing her thing, and I've always respected her for that. And now lately, she has been mentioned by the New York Times as one of the possible candidates for the Nobel Prize.
And I read that.
I couldn't be more proud and happy, first of all, because it is so well deserved in literary terms, but also because of what that would mean for the Balkan literary scene, for all of us writing here, for women writing here. And so I hope that maybe a German publishers catch up. And I'm sure, I mean, I feel sad because I love her fiction. I love her essays. She's a great essayist. She won one of the most prestigious awards for the essay. But I love her fiction. Her fiction, I mean, it is demanding. But what I love is that she has always been experimenting with the form. Something that maybe it's weird to say it in you know, 2022, but we have been lacking. And this is where I see this cut with rich Yugoslav tradition, where it sometimes it feels in the Balkan literary, biosphere or whatever you want to call it, that we kind of skipped or we wrongfully decided to ignore a part of our tradition, which was going very, you know, step by step with what was happening in Europe, what was happening with literature in the world, and we kind of went back to this kind of romantic storytelling. And she's part of that rich tradition that is questioning the form, experimenting with the form, questioning the role of the writer, questioning the role of the narrator, rethinking, I mean, how to bring a story to us. So she's one of these rare writers who are not in love with her own voice so much that she forgets the story. And this is something that's very different from other writers from her generation in this linguistic space. It's very difficult to use any kind of word because it's so complex. But sometimes I feel like we have a lot of these, you know, older men who just love her, like these grandpas who like to explain things to us and explain stories.
Oh, we have those here too.
And they seem to be so in love with their own vocabulary. and it's just this kind of prose that you feel like, okay, maybe you can enjoy it for a while, but it's just kind of, it's suffocating, and it's there's something false in it.
Mm-hmm.
And this is something she never did. I never feel with her this kind of pretentiousness, this kind of, she puts herself behind the work. And the work is just, it's just stellar. So I'm so happy to talk about her. And if I can help in any way to interest somebody in Germany to read her, then I've done enough.
If I haven't been interested already, I would be now after listening to you, because I have to say, I feel exactly the same way, even with just the little I read by her. What you just mentioned is the fact that she puts herself behind her work and behind her words. It feels like she is, for lack of a better expression, the real deal. You know, exactly. Something that I also always admire, if when someone just puts the work and the fiction or the nonfiction and the words and the thinking in the center and just steps back, because this is something I myself as a writer always aspire to be, because personally, I detest this situation we currently have, that you always have to put yourself in front of everything just in order to promote stuff, you know, and that nobody's even looking at your work anymore, only like on second glance, like first of all, it's like, what's your Instagram presence? What's your this? What's your that? And I feel by reading her, that really resonated with me, that this is someone you expressed to me how much you loved Cultural of Lies, which I then picked up. And I have to say, it was an incredibly challenging read for many reasons. For one, of course, because like I mentioned earlier, that I'm not really familiar with the whole political scope, what she's talking about. So references she makes sometimes, I guess, escape me and have to read on and on, which is good. So, you know, you learn stuff. But also, you mentioned that her fiction is formally so interesting. But I feel like this essay collection is formally also incredibly interesting, because it's not straight up essays, no? It's not like... Yes. I start with a hypothesis, and then I argue my way through it with a little bit of sprinkling of personal anecdotes, and then the essay is done. But it's like, it's more, I feel like the whole thing, I mean, I know that this is the Culture of Lies as a book has not been conceptualized as a book, but it's like a collection of articles and stuff. But it feels like it could have been conceptualized as a book. It feels like it's a symphony or a cacophony, you know, something like that, like voices and forms and trains of thought that you sit back and you just sort of take in, first of all. And as much as there's a lot of thought and information, there's also a lot of feeling that comes across. And she does so with incredible intelligence and sense of humor. Sometimes she puts herself in it. Exactly. Here. Yes, yeah. Absolutely. Sometimes she puts herself in it in a very funny way, shall we say, you know. I really, that there's one essay, I only read it in German, and I'm guessing in English maybe it's like Popes and Parrots or something, priests and Parrots, which is a little bit about what you were talking about these traditions and the writers. What can you tell us about this book? Like, how would you, because I feel it's incredibly hard to summarize.
And, you know, I feel like maybe we shouldn't summarize it, but we can maybe like inspire people to pick it up. And that's for me, I mean, the story, my personal story with this book was that, so I was born in Yugoslavia, in the part that is now Croatia, in Zagreb. And my parents left when my brother and I, we were very small. They left right before the war. So... I always had this question of what would have happened if we had stayed? Why did we go? Did we go from this capital city to this village in Bosnia? You know, the war had not yet started. My parents always told me, well, you know, the climate had changed, the political climate had changed. And I had trouble understanding that. And then I read this one essay in Culture of Lies. Actually, Dubravka talks about this a lot in other works too, but where she describes this, how this climate is changing in Croatia right before the war. And she describes, to me, this image of, pure Croatian air being sold in cans, on kiosks. To me, that was enough to imagine my parents, who are not Croatian, at that point starting to feel we're not welcome here, including my father, who was born there and grew up there, and it was his city. We are not welcome here. So this, for me, her essay kind of gave me the perspective of what was going on a personal family level. And then I could connect with this thing. Okay, this is why I, as you know, a four-year-old, was not welcome here. And then, of course, I, you know, read about this woman who is writing about all of this, and people are turning their backs on her. Her colleagues, she was a university, she still is a university professor, but she was a university professor She was in the Slavics department. She taught, you know, Russian writers, Slavic writers, and then all of these university professors who you would expect to have some sort of common, you know, sense. No, they all turned their backs on her. And she was the one saying, look around you. Do you see what's happening? Mm-hmm. Do you know where this leads? And then what happens is, you know, that because of this nationalist revival, she's publicly proclaimed a witch. Books are being burned. Again, the fact that literary professors have nothing against, are not speaking up against books being burned, that in itself, you know, speaks volumes. And she was against this, and then she, you know, goes into exile. So for me, when I came across this book, it was this moment of just understanding what was going on, and understanding it also, what you said, from a personal perspective, from a woman's perspective, from a literary perspective, all of these pieces of, you know, all of these puzzle pieces that were missing from my own personal story. And what I loved also is in this book, how she deals with the changes that happened in the language, and how, you know, there was this violence that started in the language, and how you can see it. She has this great essay about the textbook that I read it in Croatian, so I'm not sure about the translation.
That's okay. You know,
the first book that children get, where you learn how to write letters. It's like this cool textbook. And she compares her Yugoslav textbook to the one that is now changed, that she picked up in 1990. And then she describes how the words are changing, you know? So you have like the alphabet, and you have, you know, A's for this, B's for that. And then she says, suddenly we don't have all these different names, you know, Orthodox names, Catholic names, Muslim names, all of them working together. No, everything is simplified. Suddenly, you know, everything is gone, and this book no longer has a real connection to real life. It's kind of an imaginary world, whereas our book was, okay, here's this guy and this person, and are going to work in a factory, and they're going to make this, and she knew which factory it was, and she knew what it was. So there was this break with reality, this break between language and reality, and this violence in the language. I think she's, you know, spot on tackling those issues. So for me, I mean, it's hard to separate my personal experience of Culture of Lies and many other of her essays, and also just say, oh, these are also just great essays.
But I feel like these are the best books, you know, because I mean, in the end, we're also like, we consist of the books that we read and that make us, you know, and you know, you might have a different view on a book that I also love, and you might love it for completely different reasons, you know, because it resonates with something. Yeah, exactly. And when I was thinking about all of these things also that you were just saying and mentioning, I felt that a lot of this felt familiar to me because it reminds me of the Middle East, you know, and of all these. I mean, obviously the Middle East was never one country, but I mean, all these cultural dissonances and at the same time, one big people as such, you know, the Arabs, as they are called, you know, which is always super funny to me. And share
they still,
a language.
Sorry, they still put you in that category in Germany?
Of course. You know, this is also something that, you know, I would love to talk about now that we have the segue. Let's do it even now. It's like, when you get on stage, what do you feel most comfortable being identified as? Like, is it okay for you if someone says Bosnian writer?
Honestly, I don't really care.
You don't care, okay.
As long as it is not used for some purpose other than literature. I just feel like, to me, it always kind of escapes me, because it's such it's still such a new notion. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Right?
Yeah.
Nationality, state, where you're from, the idea that all of this is connected and that language is connected to it, that is very, very new and very young. And I always feel like why is this important? And the fact that you could argue, well, it's important to give you some context, then I have to say it's not enough to just say Bosnian or Croatian or Serbian, because you are kind of taking away from me history and a kind of space, a linguistic space. You're not explaining the tradition I come from as a writer. Yeah. You're not explaining my personal history. So it's not a some sort of Yugo nostalgia thing. It's mm-hmm. just, no, if you need this to explain my context, well, you need more than that. And when people ask me, like, what do you consider yourself? I like to say, I don't spend time considering myself.
That's a good answer, yeah.
Yeah. It's like, I don't sit around considering myself. I'm right. I do things. It's just, to me, you know, when I talk about the literary tradition you come from, it makes no sense to say, okay, I'm Serbian, my parents are Serbian, so I belong to the tradition of, for example, Danilo Kiš, but I do not belong to the tradition of Dubravko Ugrešić. Mm-hmm. They belong to the same tradition. Yeah. I mean, to me, the fact that I actually recently discovered, I think it's her very first book, and it's from the 70s, and it's called Pose for Prose.
Mm.
And there are three longer short stories, like three stories in one book, but longer stories. There's this one story that I thought, this is so modern and so refreshing, and I wish people were writing this today, but it made sense to be, you know, written in the 70s, but nobody talked about this to me. And it's just this story of a woman who wants to write, and then she meets a man and she falls in love with him, and the man is explaining to her how she should write her story.
Of course.
And he's constantly not happy with the way she's writing her story. And she's like trying and trying. And he's saying, you cannot do this. You cannot have that. And it's funny because when you look at the rest of Dubravka's opus, it's all the things that he tells her not to do. You see that throughout
she's
years,
doing.
She went on. Yeah. You know, you cannot use this name. This is not a name. This is just a common woman's name. You cannot have that in a, and things like that. And then in the end, he goes on to write. They meet years later. He goes on and he writes a story, and it's bad. The story is bad. And then the story, it's very meta. And what I love about Dubravka is that she can be meta in a very funny way. In the end, she takes his text and she improves it. So the final piece that we have within the story is actually, you know, a woman fixing a man's story. And I thought, and this was in the 70s that she wrote this, and I thought, this is so brilliant, you know, I love this. So to me, it's just to say that I'm not part of that tradition is sad. It's you know, impoverishing. It's something that doesn't make sense. So there is always this, are we post-Yugoslav? Does that explain us? But I just hate constantly being this post hyphenated writer. Yeah. But you know, it's I feel like I don't want anybody to take away from my context and my personal history and my family history and the tradition, the rich literary tradition that I'm happy to be part of.
Now I have to sort of
I'm sorry.
Go like, through what? No, don't be. I love it. Yeah, no, don't. Really don't. Inspiring. I love it. No, that's what I love. You know, it's also, you know, this is one of the reasons why I started this podcast in the first place, being like, oh, okay, I love talking to writers and writer friends, you know, such as yourself, about what they read and what makes them, you know, because I mean, when we met, I already had read your book and I loved it. And I mean, we discovered several really nice synchronicities in our books, like both our main heroines exactly. have the same name yeah. and all of these yeah. things. So so that was like, it already resonated with me, even with you know, me not having any personal connection to the cultural background that you describe. So, and I feel it's the same with literary traditions that we come from. And also it's always, I feel it's so limiting to even put labels on anything, because really, how do I know what literary tradition I come from? Because everything I consume in terms of text runs yeah. through me like water, you know, yeah. and something leaves something inside me, and it might come out now, it might come out in 10 years. And maybe someone picks up on it. Maybe even I don't pick up on it, you know, or maybe even I just pick up on it while I'm writing or even after. And so it's like, I feel we read and we love things and they resonate with us. And subconsciously, we sort of stealing, taking from it, being inspired by it. And also in your case, and I think we know this from personal experience, what you just said about cultural flies, we sort of manage to read our own story in a new way that it suddenly makes sense. If this makes sense, you know, what you just said about cultural flies.
I mean, completely. And the another thing that to me was, you know, new about this thing is that you had a woman in Croatia, you know, belonging to that space, talking about what Croatia is doing wrong. And this was a very new way for me, even though it was written before the war, this essay, the fact that it's not this self-victimizing and this thing of poor us, look what they're doing to us. Like, she could have written that book. If she had lived in Serbia, she would have written about Serbia. And this is what I love, that you're writing about your own backyard. Because I felt like that's also another connection which I find and I'm happy to find, is that I wanted to write about my own backyard and what, you know, so-called my people did wrong. And this is something that doesn't happen a lot when you talk about the Balkans. It's constantly this whataboutism. It's constantly this pointing your finger at the other person, which of course there, you know, we can talk about guilt and we can talk about blame, but we have to talk about personal our responsibility. And for her to say, this is my city and we are doing this and I'm not comfortable with this, to me, that was very brave and very empowering for me to also do that about my own hometown. To say, this is what happened here, and we did this, and this was not right. So in many ways, she was a pioneer, and
trailblazer,
and exactly, and she suffered for it. I mean, you know.
Now I was going to ask you. Yeah. You just mentioned the fact that she was discredited and like literally witch hunted.
Yes,
which I also read about. I'm very curious about that. What happened? Like, who declared her a witch? I mean, this is a concept. I mean, it's not unfamiliar because obviously, you know, calling women witches who are visionary and who might be strong and opinionated is not something new. And sadly, it's still prevalent today. But I mean, tell us about it. What happened?
Yeah. So basically, in this moment, there was this, you know, nationalist revival in all of these different states in Yugoslavia. And what was happening in Croatia was, together with this, you know, nationalistic national revival, you, of course, had all these, you know, coming back from the 40s, these kind of fascist ideas of pure Croatian, you know, having only, you know, Catholic Croats in Croatia, things like that. And since she was speaking up against this idea of pure Croatian air and the way non-Croats are being treated, and that she was basically, you know, afraid of where that kind of discourse could lead to, they kind of saw her as a traitor, you know, as a self-hating Croat traitor who's against, you know, independence or whatever. Was not in line with this, you know, nationalist revival, and she was, you know, this Yugoslav or pro-Serb whore, basically, which she never was. It's just, she was like, you know, it's very difficult to criticize anything in the Balkans because they immediately think you're pro something, and what she was obviously against was nationalism in all its forms. Not just Croatian. So, you know, the media, it was the papers who kind of portrayed her as this traitor, this nationalist traitor, this pro-Serb witch, this, you know, person who is against all things Croatian, etc. And it was the newspapers who called her a witch. I mean, I can't tell you the name who it was, but it kind of spread.
No,
it spread in many ways. And then she left. I know she told me that actually she got the DEA Day scholarship in Germany, and it helped her actually get away, and that's how it started. And then she went to live in Amsterdam. She never went back. But you know, it's interesting because years later, I experienced being called a witch publicly by a Serbian guy, by a Serbian man in power.
Wow.
Using, you know, a public Facebook account to, you know, connect me with whatever he thought witchcraft was, commenting on my tattoos, things that I write, things that he disagrees with. And I thought, well, you know what? Thank you. I'm happy to be part of that tradition. I'm happy, you know, but, you know, the fact I'm not happy that we still have witch hunt going on. But the word itself is being revindicated in a way.
It's incredible that this is still something that is actually happening in our day and age. Through the grapevine, I actually heard that you have a couple of tattoos that commemorate your love for her.
Well, I have one thing that I love about Dubravka is her, you know, the tradition she comes from, which is this very rich Slavic tradition. She translated also from Russian. I know she translated Daniel Harms, but also other, and there's this rich Slavic tradition that you can see, and, you know, this irony and humor that you can see in her works. And one of my favorite books is Master and Margarita. So, you know, one of the tattoos that I had to get was Margarita flying on a broom. And it really connected with something that, you know, the way Dubravka used this word witch, and she kind of reclaimed it and turned it around. And she writes in one of the essays, "I bought my broom on my own with my own money.
I love it.
And I fly alone." And to me, this, when I read this sentence, it was like, I still get goosebumps because it was just so empowering for me to say, yeah, you know what? My broomstick is my own and I fly alone. Like, nobody gave me this broom.
And also, there's no room for you on my broomstick.
There's like, no please. Room. Yeah, you know? No room on my broom. That would be like.
That's a good title. No room on my broom.
Yeah, exactly.
Amazing.
And you know, this thing of being self-sufficient and with her own work actually managing, you know, to fly away. I just thought this is so empowering and so great that she's not victimizing herself, but she's saying, oh, yeah, I am a witch big time and I'm getting, you know, away from here on my own terms. And then years later, well, one of her last books, which is The Fox, it's I'm sad because in English you cannot hear the feminine. It's you cannot hear the gender, but in Serbo-Croatian, the word is for the female fox. And she talks about the position of the writer, the way the writer is kind of like a fox living in between worlds, and kind of constantly tricking both worlds in a way in order to survive. I had a little fox tattooed, which for some reason everybody thinks is my cat, and I'm constantly saying it's not my cat, it's a fox. Read Dubravka Ugrešić, it's a fox. So yeah, I mean, she has been really inspiring, not just tattoo wise but in many ways, so that I also when I was called a witch, I kind of, you know, had a role model to, you know, follow and to think, okay, this is what you can do. And this is how you can reclaim this title and turn it around and use it as a weapon.
With everything you were telling me, it really does make sense that she's being rediscovered at the moment, you know. I feel, you know, from little I know, just the times that we're in, where I mean, in Germany we have the same thing, that we're rediscovering women who were writing in the 50s and 60s and who were completely disregarded. I had one of my colleagues on this podcast talking about Marlene Haushofer, who wrote in the 50s, I think, and who back then, by the most prominent German literary critic, her work was deemed menstruation literature. He literally said that, Menstruationsliteratur.
Because it talks about
women. It talks about women in the home, about women in the home, about the everyday life of sometimes single mothers, you know.
Yeah, it's, that was deemed irrelevant.
Exactly, exactly. So it makes sense that these women are rediscovered now and makes me really, really happy. But I mean, talk to me a little bit about what it is like to write as a woman in the cultural context that you live in now, because I know from our private conversations and also from our mutual very good friend Rumana Buzharovska, who is also a very vocal feminist, that you guys, you fight a completely different battle than we do over here in Germany.
Well, yeah, I mean, still, you know, still trying to figure out, I think, for each one of us, on one hand, saying I am a woman writer and this is what it means and this is how it's empowering. On the other hand, saying I am a writer.
Yeah.
You know, don't just put me in this category. And why do I always have to explain myself extra just because I'm also a woman? So it's constantly a battle between these two. But with the things that we are dealing with here now, I mean, right now in Serbia, we have these massive protests, finally, long due, against, you know, the portrayal of women victims in the media, and also the fact that we have, you know, a woman is killed almost, you know, every month.
Every
day. But here it's like there's these, you know, gruesome news that we're getting, and the way the country is dealing with these deaths and these crimes and the people and the men who committed them. So it's like this kind of little awakening that we're witnessing now that I'm really happy with. But the fact is, it's still literature is still seen as this, you know, old man's world or this kind of thing that, you know, you have this older man who's going to explain things and he's going to tell you a nice story in his, you know, rich thesaurus kind of vocabulary and still it's the man we admire and not the text. It's this idea we have a genius walking among us.
Oh yeah.
And then you have to knock on that door and be very nice and docile in order to be let in. Not make a fuss, you know, don't make a scene of yourself.
Yeah.
and then maybe they let you in, and if you have their blessing, maybe you make it. And then maybe in, you know, 50 years, when you're no longer within their sexual desire, maybe they see you as, you know, a serious writer. So we're still there. Things are obviously changing. But I have to say, that's why to me, Dubravka is so, you know, revolutionary in what she did. Is, for example, just to give you an example, she has this little novel called Štefica Cvek. Štefica Cvek is a name, it's a woman's name, and it sounds really funny, it sounds like common, and it sounds banal, and this is very much in line with the Slavic tradition, you know, with some sort of Hrabalian characters and other characters that she drew from to create this common woman. And it's Štefica Cvek in the Jaws of Life. So it's very like she's even playing with this title, which is kind of like, you know, dramatic. What I love about this little novel is that it's kind of a patchwork novel. So she uses the novel this is a podcast, so the people listening cannot see it. I wish I could show the book. But inside the book, there are like these patterns on how you can cut and sew the book. Because it's this kind of, you know, women's tradition of sewing, of patchwork, of making things. But at the same time, she's doing something very experimental, which is this idea that she's building her novel as a patchwork novel. So she's taking this very, you know, typical thing connected with women, like you're not doing anything of substance, you're just like patching up things, you know, you're just sewing. It's like something that is, you know, a woman's art. And she's translating it into literature to talk about this everyday woman who is not emancipated, who is not, you know, a professor, who is not, you know, who is falling in love with these over-the-top men. And she's telling this story, you know, in this way. So you have actually the graphic part of the text, the way the text is designed. You have like little scissors, you have, you know, little patterns, cutting patterns. You have things like you open, you know, a pattern for you know, sewing something.
For sewing.
So this is just to illustrate how the way she was experimenting with text and the way she was, you know, introducing so-called non-literary themes and non-literary characters. You know, this woman that, you know, a male writer would want to maybe hook up with and use as his muse, but would never put her in her in his text. She put this these women in her text. So in this way, you know, just kind of reclaiming the literary space for topics that up until then were seen as non-literary. This is where we have to go back and rediscover these writers and say, mm-hmm. you know, she did this. And we have her to thank, you know, that today I can write my characters also menstruating or whatever, doing things that, you know, are maybe not very, very literary, but are actually very literary.
It's really freeing, isn't it? Like, I've been talking about the Scottish writer Ali Smith, who I really, really admire in terms of, like, I love her. And that when I was sitting down and starting to write the novel that I'm now at the moment trying to finish, is what I really found was that I wanted to be more experimental with form and with language in particular. And then I came across the seasonal quartet, and it just felt like someone has broke in the door, everything was wide open, basically blast away all the walls, and you're like, okay, it's possible. We can, exactly. I am allowed to do this now. I mean, I'm obviously not going to do it even as far as well as she did, but it's like, it's so, like what you are also saying, you know, you yeah. see this, you take it in, you can say thank you for doing this, for giving us, I mean, even like giving us permission to try, you know? And I was thinking, I'm not sure if this is correct. I read that somewhere, I don't know where, I read that she, Dubrovka, took classical literary texts such as, for example, Alice in Wonderland, and tried to sort of put it into a more nowness sort of context and language. And obviously your first novel is inspired by Alice in Wonderland. Yeah. Is there a connection, or is this a coincidence?
Yeah, this was a coincidence, but I have to say, obviously, the way she deals with text, the way she works with text, to me, that's where I say I feel sad. I feel like literary tradition was kind of cut at some point, and then we went back like 50 years back, not just in literary tradition, also in feminism, also in many other things, that we went back. But you know, that she was doing, and writers of her age, other writers were doing things like you know, intertextuality, metatextuality, questioning herself. This is something that, I mean, obviously, I would say comes from her, but also other writers, questioning the role of the writer as she's writing. All of these things that kind of were already happening in, you know, the 60s, in the 70s, early 80s. And then you have this cut, and then it's, you know, going back to these, you know, kind of nationalist myths and literatures, and you know, the man explaining us a story. So for me, it's just, I was also proud to discover, you know, and I don't know if it's a woman's thing, or to me, it's just, you know, this, not seeing it as any kind of competition. When you were talking about Ali Smith, and you say, maybe I'm not going to be as good as, you know, this is something I never hear a man say first.
No, of course
and
not.
And also, like, it's not about, you know, for us, it's about entering this dialogue and participating. I'm saying there's more of us, so there's, I'm learning more things, and you know, the field is getting bigger and bigger and wider, so I can play with all these different tools. And I love this. And what I got from Dubravka Ugrešić are all these different ways of looking at text, thinking intertextuality, thinking how I can use text, and how I'm allowed to use text to say my own thing. You know,
and you're allowed to play. It's
exactly,
like, you know, because I feel like all these men, they're always teaching you to be like, there's one way. There's one way, or the highway, how you should read and how you should write, you know, and you're not allowed to play. You're not allowed to have fun. And at the same time, be completely serious about what you do, you know, because I feel like that's what she does. She does take herself very seriously in
very
her craft.
Very seriously. And I mean, she
rightfully
knows,
so.
You know, she knows her shit.
Exactly. She does. Yeah, she knows her shit. Yeah.
First of all, her knowledge of you know, literature is really vast.
It's
really
incredible.
She thinks about these things. And she has this. This is also something that I learned from her, is this responsibility. When you're sitting down to write a text, that you have this, it's not just, oh, look what beautiful sentences I can make. And this, yes. I mean, we are in many ways here in the Balkans, we are still there. We still admire these men who can write a beautiful sentence and then he can write about whatever he wants to. It doesn't matter. I don't really feel that he cares about what he's writing about, but it's just like, I'm going to admire this thing for like 50 pages and you should admire the way I speak because this is these are my words. And, you know, it's this thing that she brings this responsibility of everything you've learned, of everything you have read, and the responsibility that you're entering the dialogue, which was there long before you, and it's going to be there long after you. And this is something that even if she does it with lightness, with humor, with a lot of irony, unlike many of these writers, these so-called geniuses, she actually knows she knows how to use irony.
Yeah,
in
she
a
does.
Very good way. And it's not bitter. There's still a lot of humanity in it. So this just this responsibility, and to me, this is beautiful. And there's a quote that she quotes it. She quoted in her very first book. But she, I in her interviews, I have come across this quote a lot, which was from Gabriel García Márquez, where he says, "We writers write in order to be loved." And I saw her also re-quote this, also saying, you know, women writers write in order to be loved. And the first time I read that, I had this kind of thing. Oh, wait, what do you mean? Like we want to be loved, you know? I read it in a very superficial way the first time. But then when I thought of it in a broader way, it's not romantic love. It's this thing of not saying something about myself, but entering some being kind of accepted as a human being and connecting with other human beings, you know? And what is wrong in that? What is wrong in, you know, admitting? I mean, if Márquez could could admit it, you know, what is wrong in admitting that, yeah, we want to be loved in a way that we are understood as complete human beings. And so there's also this in her work, this kind of need to find the other person, respecting your reader, respecting her, you know, for everything that she knows, for, you know, everything she's been through, respecting her and building this bridge towards the reader, and then, you know, making this connection, this sort of love. And not just, you know, me, myself, and I, this kind of self-indulgent literature.
When I read her and read about her also, I'm not sure if this is a connection she would even make or be approve of, and I'm not sure if it's, but I thought of Walter Benjamin a lot when I read her.
Yeah.
It came, like, it was, it's for me, it's a completely obvious connection.
I think she would definitely approve of this.
Okay, good. Because, you know, I mean, not only the whole exile thing, but the fact that what you were just saying, you know, this like putting myself in the text, but at the same time putting myself out and dealing with all these pieces and putting them together and taking them apart again and following your own steps in thought, you know, and then putting it into language and the reverse again. It just really reminded me of it. And I mean, I love Walter Benjamin. It's just,
Of course.
Well, I mean, the kids today, do they know them? I don't know.
Yeah. Well, there's a lot of like quoting him on Instagram and things that I know.
I know.
Yeah.
Oh, is there? I haven't. Okay. Then.
Yeah. It's kind of cool again.
Okay.
But
it's cool again.
You always wonder whether they actually read the stuff or they just, you know,
retweet. They don't.
I mean, there's definitely this connection. And I mean, to me, you know, I often wonder whether as women in the Balkans, and not just in the Balkans, we actually had more room to experiment because we were not taken seriously.
Yeah.
And we were often, you know, you and I talk about this a lot, the high standards that we put on ourselves and you know, the expectations and this constant need to prove that we are allowed to sit at the table and that we are allowed to you know, create something, that then we are actually, you know, playing, experimenting and putting exactly this, that I don't see myself as a genius, you know, I just see myself as a worker who is, you know, trying to do something, and maybe I'm going to fail. And maybe the idea that we have, belief that we can fail, that not everything I write is a masterpiece, that not every sentence I write is maybe good, that I can also write an average thing or a bad thing. This actually allows us to experiment much more and to try different things and to do different things. And in this, you know, she's not alone, but she's one of the, I think, most interesting voices. If you look at the Nin Prize, which is it used to be the most important Yugoslav literary prize. Now it's now it's just in Serbia. She's one of the very few women who got it with her novel called Forcing the Stream of Consciousness novel. That's the title. and it's one of the most experimental books that ever won that award, you know, and still there were people questioning, you know, well, maybe this other guy who wrote this, you know, should have, like, it's still there.
These guys, but, I mean, come on.
She was so experimental precisely because she was not worried about having the, you know, the title of our genius writer. Like, we already have those. We have those with those titles. And actually, they're doing much. Maybe they've written more, but they've written the same book over and over again. Because their books,
that's it, right?
Their books are there to say something about them. And she writes books to say something about all of us. And to say something about writing books in itself. To say something about language. To say something about the context. So to me, it's like 10 times more interesting. You know, picking up two or three books of her, you're going to find different, very different things and experimental things and get ideas than, for example, reading, you know, 10 novels by some writer who right now is considered, I'm not going to name names.
Come on, say a name, say one name.
No, but you know, it's like, it's to me, it's this is why I love these kind of things, these kind of podcasts where, you know, women writers, we get to talk about someone else. And there's this kind of solidarity. It's not just talking about myself, but talking about another woman, and hopefully kind of reclaiming, saying like, no, she is my tradition. It's this woman. It's not this, you know.
Yeah, I love that too. Like when we were talking about Deborah Levy on this podcast, my colleague Christina, who brought her with us, she said this very, very beautiful sentiment about the exact thing that we're doing now. She said, this is what we all are. We are part of the a tradition. And so one of us goes a step and then the next one goes a step, you know, and this is like you were just saying, it's not me, the genius, it's us sharing a space and learning from each other and taking something in and putting a tradition forward. And maybe, I mean, this is again, like very in the gender binary, but I always feel like this whole sharing aspect is very female quality because I don't know, maybe we've been socialized and educated that way in terms of sharing and nurturing and finally reclaiming that for ourselves, you know, and not to nurture some husband or some genius as a muse, you know, or whatever, but like as ourselves. And for me, I mean, this is a very personal thing, but I feel the like making this podcast, talking to all of you, reading all these books, getting introduced to all these works. And I mean, obviously, you know, going on my reading journey on my own is also incredibly freeing from something that I've been brought up with, is because my father, who was an Arab, Arab again, you know, Saudi, that's one of the Arab, and an immigrant. So I was brought up with the sentiment from very early on that I have to do five times harder. With everything, like I have to try, like I have to be five times better than anyone because I'm a girl, and I'm the child of an immigrant, and I'm the child of a bad immigrant. No, I'm not the child of a French immigrant. I'm the child of a Muslim Arab immigrant. And my father really instilled this in me from very, very early on. Like education for him was really important. And he sat down with me and did my homework from very early on. And so he really monitored my education. And so I always had this feeling that, you know, I had to be really, really good in order to even, you know, be allowed to open my mouth and say something. So this is something that is incredibly freeing, to share all these ideas and thoughts and texts. And it helps me to be like, oh yeah, maybe I'm actually good enough. You know, I can open my mouth now. I learned and I keep learning, and that's nice.
Yeah, so totally.
I love that.
Yeah, and I'm so happy you shared that. And also, you know, when you realize, it's this empowering moment when you realize, instead of fighting to enter this canon, you know, now, I mean, now I'm talking about the, you know, post-Yugoslav canon, to enter this, you know, to win this prize, to be, you know, in these textbooks, to enter this canon, why not create our own space?
Yeah.
You know, I don't need to be accepted by, you know, a gray-haired, bearded man. I have nothing up against gray-haired men. Just want to make that disclaimer. But in this, you know, symbolic way, instead of waiting for that, I mean, for me, myself, I had to do it all by myself, you know. My journey started with me translating myself, because I knew it wouldn't happen on its own, because you know, in order to get translated, you need to win an award, which they're not going to give me in the Balkans. You need to you know, be sent off to festivals, meet people. They're not going to send me off. They're going to send some, you know, 60-year-old man. So I was like, you have to do it on your own. And I'm not victimizing myself here, just taking responsibility and saying, okay, you have your literary space. It's very hard for me to get into there. So I'm going to go look for my own, or make my own space, you know, and this is, I feel like, what you're also doing with this podcast. And what we are talking about is like, okay, there's this, and this is the mainstream, and this is what's, you know, hailed
popular,
as whatever, popular, but we are making our own space and like looking into, and this was also this part of responsibility for me, discovering Dubravka Ugrešić, not because she was in a textbook, which she absolutely deserves to be part of, but she's not. Not because she won some award, not because anybody was telling me about her, and I studied literature, but I had to discover her on my own, you know? And to say, it's also what you said, you know, the way women read, not saying, oh, look what I did, you know? I reread Alice in Wonderland. Wow. No, it's like not, it's not new.
Yeah,
somebody was here doing that before me. It's just I'm part of entering the dialogue and taking all these tools. And we go back here to that question of whether we write in order to be loved, which I think it's a beautiful thing of saying, I write because I want to establish a dialogue, because I want, you know, to talk to someone, not because I want to hear myself talk.
Yeah.
And this is something I absolutely learned from her. I'm so excited. Like my mind is, you know, I'm like the queen of digression here, but
I love it.
I feel like it's just such an interesting topic for me, and especially you and I could talk about these things, I think, forever.
I mean, you and I, we could do like a 10-hour podcast on anything, basically. I'm kind of tempted to say this was a really beautiful sentiment to put at the end, even though I have like a million other things on my list, you know, but that's okay. I mean, I feel like we covered so much, so much ground, and also because obviously the main aim was for our audience to get to know Dubravka and her work. Yeah. And I feel like with your enthusiasm, if anyone's not interested now, then it's really their own fault. You really did everything you could. And I'm really excited actually to dive in more, because I'm really determined to find at least the fiction that has been translated into English, so I can maybe even read it in English. And maybe someone listening out here by like the German publishers are Suhrkamp and Berlin Verlag. Hello, publishers. Hello. Maybe, hello. Maybe you wanna, like, I'm sure Lana would write a preface or something. You know,
whatever it takes. I mean, it's for me, it's even ridiculous that I write something for her. You know, because actually,
I know what you mean.
Book, she was so kind to give me a blurb, because she.
I know what you mean.
But yeah, I mean, if you can find, I don't know, some of my favorite works are The Museum of Unconditional Surrender. And there's also a lot of talk about, you know, what it means to be an immigrant. And the latest one, which is The Fox, which I just loved. And then these early short stories, if you can find them. And of course, essays. I'm sure you can find her essays in English. I guess you can also find them somewhere online. I hope so. She wrote for, I don't know if she still writes for the White Review, but she wrote for it for a while. So you can find things, and German publishers, you can find things in English, for sure. So yeah, let's hope there's a little revival of Ugrešić. You don't have to wait for her to win the Nobel Prize to publish.
No, which she might not, because now this year a woman has taken it, so it's going to take 15 more years for the next woman, to take it. But Lana, you will be, first of all, I mean, we're going to put all of this info again in the description of the podcast. We're going to do links and everything. And Lana, you will be in Berlin shortly on a residency this November also. And also you will be in Berlin in this coming February for a whole year, because you are... on the DRD scholarship, and I'm super happy because
Dubrovka
got it exactly. Yeah. So I mean, for the audience,
she wrote
the recommendation.
Recommendation, which is, to me, I said just having her recommendation is enough. You don't have to give me a scholarship, but yeah.
See, this is again this like all us being like part of a tradition and sharing space and making space for each other, which I love. It's like I mean, it's the thing that I love most is seeing how this sort of manifests and grows, and let the circle grow, as you said recently in a different context when we were talking about something. But so the German audience will for sure be able to see you and hear from you in the near future, and maybe we can even like do a little event on Ugrešić. That would be nice, like have a panel discussion or something. That would be super great. Let's talk about that. And also your short story collection, which is called Milk Teeth, I think in the original, it's going to be published in German in January with the title.
Other different title.
Yes, Mann im Mond, Man on the Moon.
Also by the translated same... by Rebecca Zeinsinger,
exactly.
All my love to Rebecca if she's listening. And
yes,
sure she
Rebecca
is.
You did a great job with the translation. We always like to mention the translators, which reminds me, maybe just like at the very end, mention Dubrovka's translators, who is Barbara Ankoviak on the one hand, and then a couple who I'm guessing is married. I mean, we have that a lot. Like, we have also like Arabic German couples who translate. It's called Mirjana and Klaus Wittmann.
They also translate them. A well-known translating couple from Serbo-Croatian. So yeah, and they've also translated some Yugoslav classics. Yeah, here's to them as well.
All the love to translators, since Lana and I are also translators. So without you guys, the world would be not such a nice place. Exactly. Anyway, Lana, thank you so much for being on the podcast. And
thank you for having me. And thank you for creating this wonderful place for us to share our reading experience and stories.
Let's hope for it to grow. And thank you. And bye, my darling.
Bye.
Das war die neue Ausgabe von Fempire, dem Podcast über Frauen, die schreiben. Heute mit der bosnischen Autorin Lana Bastasic, die uns ihre Heldin Dubravka Ugrešić näher gebracht hat. Wie immer findet ihr sämtliche Infos und Links zu unserem Gespräch in der Beschreibung des Podcasts verlinkt. Klickt auch gerne auf Abonnieren, folgt uns auf Instagram unter fempire_podcast und empfehlt uns all euren bücherverrückten Freundinnen weiter. Bis zum nächsten Mal wünsche ich euch erstmal eine ganz gute Zeit. Mein Name ist Seda Shachayat, Schriftstellerin, Übersetzerin, Literaturaktivistin und Host von Fempire, dem Podcast über Frauen, die schreiben.